when you think of Parshas Yisro, the first thing that comes to mind, or the first thing that should come to mind, is the Aseres HaDibros. It's the Parsha of Kabbalah Satorah. The Ten Commandments are not only critical in Yiddishkeit, which obviously they are, but it's really in the consciousness of all moral societies, pretty much. You know, until very recently, you could find the Ten Commandments in every American courtroom. You know, there's a painting of Moses bringing down the tablets of law in the main committee room of the House of Lords, according to Lord Jonathan Sacks, who understood, I guess, who's seen it. So you had this is always it's something that's in the consciousness of most moral societies. Now, of course, we're Talmidim of Torah, so we're well aware that that phrase, Ten Commandments, is a really bad mistranslation, right? Because the word, you know, the word Dibros does not mean commandments. In fact, I don't think there's any Rishonim that holds that there are ten mitzvos in the Aseres HaDibros. There are ten utterances. It's somewhere between 13 and 16 mitzvos in the Aseres HaDibros. So it like, sort of begs the question. So if it's not ten commandments, if it's not ten mitzvos, according to any of the Monea mitzvos, then what exactly are these ten utterances? What distinguishes them into ten categories as opposed to, you know, if it was 13 or 16, I get it, so it's categorized by mitzvos. But what makes something an utterance and something else not? Meaning if it's it doesn't even track to being ten mitzvos. Furthermore, there's one of the Ten Commandments that seems totally out of place. The Isra of Lo Sachmod is completely different than all the rest. Right? There used to be a game on Sesame Street, you know, which one of these is not like the others, right? So if you had to line up the Ten Commandments, which one of these is not like the others, Lo Sachmod is totally unlike the others. The rest of the list involves action or inaction. The first involves Jewish and really universal human belief or attitude. It's hard to imagine a lo sase min haTorah about something that's really just a feeling or a passion. And this, of course, was discussed. There's the famous Ibn Ezra on this, on how the Torah can even request of us, or require of us, lo sachmod. It's a feeling. If I feel it, I feel it. If I don't feel it, I don't need to be told not to do it. So, you know, what does it even mean? And after all, you know, isn't life really an observance of Torah really about controlling our passions and just not acting on them? So we're supposed to not have the passion to begin with? We're supposed to not have the desire to begin with? It's a little bit hard to understand. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Zichrono Livracha, points out, the quote from direct quote from him is, in his last book that was published posthumously, that envy, covetousness, desiring what someone else has, is an emotion, not a thought, a word, or a deed. And surely we can't help our emotions. They used to be called the passions precisely because we are passive in relation to them. So how can envy be forbidden at all? Meaning it's something that just happens. You feel it, it pops up in your mind, in your heart, or it doesn't pop up in your mind or your heart. How could it be that there's such an iser? And finally, third question, there is a very, very famous medrash, Yalkut Shimoni, which tells us, Kishenigla Malkam Litin Es HaTorah LiYisrael, when Hashem came to give the Torah to Klal Yisrael, he didn't only reveal himself to Klal Yisrael, he tried all the nations. He first offered the Torah to Bnei Esav. Oh, what does it say? Lo tirtzach. So, what do you mean? We come from Rotzchim. So he said, okay, let's try the next group. So haluch leitzel b'nei amun umav. Amar lem mekavnu atem es haTorah. Amar lo maksivba lo tinav. It says lo tinav. Oh well, what do you mean? We come from the youth, the shnei b'nos lot. It's not shaykh that we can observe such a thing. Haluch umatzes b'nei yishmal. Amar lem mekavnu atem es haTorah. Amar lo maksivba lo tignov. Amar lo kol atzman shalaviyim listimaya. That's how our how our patriarch made a living. Shemar v'huya pera adam. Ve'lo yisu uma b'uma shalcha haluch ve. So essentially the reason the nations of the world rejected the Torah is it included Lo Tirtzach and Lo Tinav and Lo Tignov. So all of these Yisurim appeared in the Torah and they couldn't live with that. Problem is, they got to live with that anyway. Even so, you reject the Torah, good, so you don't have Taryag mitzvahs. So now you don't have to observe the mitzvah of shatness, okay? But you know what you still have to observe? L'tirtzach, l'tignov, l'tinov. All of them still apply. They're all part of the Shem Mitzvah B'nai Noach. So they have to observe them anyway. So what kind of argument is that? Oh, we can't take the Torah because of that. You take the Torah or not, you're stuck with those anyhow. So it's very difficult to understand, you know, that idea of the Medrash, the rejecting the, you know, it's like HaKadosh Baruch Hu tricked them. You know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should have said to them, well, whether you can live with that or not, it doesn't really relate to this choice that you're making right now, because you're going to have to live with that one way or the other. What do you think about the rest of it? Like, what do you think about kashrus? You know, like that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu should have said to them. What does it mean that that's why they don't get the Torah? So Rabbi Sacks, Zichron Levracha, in his final book, Studies in Spirituality, points out that the Aseres HaDibros are most often and most logically divided into two sets of five. Right? You have the first set that's been on the Makom, the second set's been on the Chavero, and they mostly fit those categories except for Kibbut Aveim, which doesn't really, so everyone tries to figure out, you know, how to fetch out that Kibbut Aveim is really been on the Makom. Gimel Shutfin Yesh Ba'adam, and Cheschinuch Mitzvah Lamed Gimel, and Safik has been on the Chavir B'Lel Makom, five Nafkamina, okay, whatever, we can give a nice shir about it. But for the most part, it divides into those two categories. However, maybe there's room to argue that it divides differently. You know, we have 10 of something else also, right? There are Eser Makos. And we don't divide Eser Makos into two sets of five. How do we divide Eser Makos? Shabbi Danasi. Yeah, we say it in the Pesach Seder. He divided the Eser Makos into Tzach Hadash Be'achav, essentially into three groups of three, with one final one serving as an exclamation point on all of it. So Rabbi Sacks suggests maybe the Eser Makos fit this, maybe the Aseres HaDibros fit better, more neatly, into three groups of three. The first three, having one God, having no other God, and not taking God's name in vain, those are pretty similar to each other, right? They all have to do with Hashem, who's the authority behind all the mitzvahs, right? To appreciate Hashem, to appreciate Hashem's uniqueness, and to appreciate the total awe and respect that we have when relating to Hashem. So it's all like direct Hashem stuff. The next three, Shabbos, Kibbut Aveim, and Lo Tirtzach, the Yisur to murder. This one's a little bit more challenging, but he suggests they're all about createdness. Shabbos is Maisa Bereishis, it's the creation of the world. Kibbut Aveim reminds us of how we were created, because we personally were brought into the world by a father and a mother. And Lo Tirtzach reminds us that we're all created in the Tzelem Elokim, right? That the nature of the creation of man is the Tzelem Elokim. And that's why it's such a serious thing to violate murder. And then the final group of three, the Isra of adultery, stealing, and bearing false witness, they're all basic institutions of society, that no moral society can allow for these things to happen, where you know, people are committing adultery and stealing and lying in court. You just can't function that way. Society can't operate that way. The integrity of marriage, the rights to private property, administration of justice. You know, when these things come under attack, when these things start, there's a hysteroscopy in these things, you see a society just falling apart. Right, meaning that's these are the backbones of the backbone of a functioning society, and those groupings actually fit much more neatly than the two groups of five. But really, what they also do is they serve to highlight how much of a misfit Lo Sachmod is, because it doesn't fit into any of those three categories, right? Meaning, a society can function if I see my neighbor's Tesla and I'm driving my Hyundai and I'm like, Tesla looks like a better car than this, you know? A society can function that way. It does, right? A society can function that way. It may not be the thought that I should that should go through my mind, but you can function that way. So there are two ideas that could help us answer these questions. First, an idea that is a fundamental of Yiddishkeit, and that is that we do have control over our emotions, over our desires. In fact, it's clear that what a person believes affects what a person feels. It affects a person's emotions, it affects a person's desires. A narcissist, for instance, is quick to take offense. Why? Because they think that other people are always talking about them or disrespecting them, when usually people just aren't really paying much attention to them. But they think that the whole world is about them, that everyone is always focused on them. So because they believe that, even though it happens to not be true, they all of a sudden feel much more offended whenever someone says something. We feel envy because in some way a person feels envious because in some deep way he feels entitled to what the other person has. I'm just as smart as that guy. Why does he have more money than me? Right? I'm just as nice as that guy. Why does he have more popularity than me? I'm just as, you know, a big Talmud Chacham as that person. Why does he have more, more Talmidim, more anything, whatever people are envious of. We feel entitled to what other people have. I got a call from a Talmud of mine once that he had just finished his first semester in Harvard Law School, and he was struggling, and not so much because his own grades didn't live up to his expectations of himself, which was true. I mean, keep in mind, like, to do well in Harvard Law School, you don't need to be above average, you need to be above the average Harvard Law student, right? So you're already starting with a very, very, you know, thin slice of humanity, of people who are very, very accomplished and very, very intelligent, and you got to be above average of that. So okay, you know, it's not the end of the world. But his what he was struggling with was that all of his chevra, his study partners, all did exceptionally well on their exams, and he didn't. What did they do that he didn't do? Why did he have to give up all that time with his wife and all that time that he could have spent learning if he wasn't going to get the results that he wanted? And he couldn't help but feel like a certain sense of envy of his friends who did get the grades that they were looking for. So it's really not an easy thing to control, but a person has to work on the belief that, and it takes years of working on oneself to realize that what the other person has makes no difference whatsoever to you. Even if the grading's on a curve. Even if there's X amount of whatever it is to go around, whether that person gets it, whether it's money or whatever else, whether that person gets it has no impact on you. If we believe that we're here on a mission from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we've been given a certain toolbox by Hashem to achieve our purpose, my mission is totally unaffected by other people's achievements. I remember once when I was a Talmud here in Yeshiva, a guy who was a little bit older than me, we'll call him Noam, because that was his name. He got engaged to a 24-year-old girl. He was 21 at the time. I was 20, he was 21. He was in Rav Parnas' shir. It was a funny thing, because Rav Parnas had just given a shmooze on Thursday. His Parsha shmooze was about that you have to date older girls, because he realized the age gap and the population growth, and he said, you got to date older girls. And the next day, Noam was in Rav Parnas' shir, got engaged to a girl who was 3 years older than him. And everyone's like, wow, what a Talmud. You know, mamish the next day. So I remember the family was close with the Yudins. The girl's family was close with the Yudins. And Rabbi Arya Yudin, who was not yet rabbi at the time, Arya Yudin said to his father, yeah, I feel bad for the older sister. She had an older sister that wasn't engaged. And Rabbi Yudin said to Arya, he said, Do you think Noam's a better fit for the older sister than for the one that's only 3 years older than him? And he's like, no, that's the creepiest thing to say. Why would you say that? Like, why would you even like say those words? And Rabbi Yudin's like, so why do you feel bad for her? Meaning this simcha has nothing to do with her. Meaning this isn't, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided that the sister should find her b'sheret. There's nothing for the older sister to be jealous of. Now, I don't think Rabbi Yudin would have said it in that way to the older sister, but he was trying to teach his son Ahashkafas HaChayim, that what other people have has absolutely nothing to do with what you have. Oftentimes, I've found that when there's a simcha that happens in a family, that there's like simcha gerera simcha, that if it's handled properly, that it just brings more simcha into the family, and that one will lead to the other, and that you don't lose out for being happy for your sibling who experiences a simcha. You know, that's the way life works sometimes. That it doesn't always go, things don't always go in order. Of all the things not to go in order, that's not such a bad one, right? You know, Nebuch, we see children die before parents sometimes. That's awful, right? But we don't get to make up the order of the way things go. And we have to realize that it has nothing to do with, you know, what someone else has. It has nothing to do with the brachas HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives me. It's not that Hakadosh Baruch Hu is deciding, okay, which one of these children of the of these parents should I decide to give you know to give the bracha of marriage to? I'm going to give it to that one instead of that one. That's not the way it works. And second of all, second yesod is that since the beginning of time, envy has been one of the prime drivers of violence in society. Cain murdered Hevel because of envy. Avram and Yitzchak had to fear for their lives because of the recognition that others would be envious of their beautiful wives. Yosef was sold down to Mitzrayim and nearly killed because of his brother's envy. Even anti-Semitism is based in envy. The Gemara tells us that Har Sinai is called Har Sinai because Misham Yorda Sina Liolam. So the nations of the world, they envied our chosenness. They envied the idea that we're the Amon Ivchar. So many have declared themselves to be chosen, but there's like a visceral recognition on the part of humanity that the truth is that we are the Amon Ivchar. And that recognition that we are the Amon Ivchar brings with it a certain sense of envy. There is a mitzvah that we receive prior to Kabbalah Satorah. V'higbalta es ha'am saviv. In the Sefer Panim Yafos, he comments that when you look at the letters that border the letters of the word har, meaning that are the gvul around the letters hey resh, the letters that border hey and resh, you will find that the hey is flanked by, in the aleph bays, by a dalet and a vav, and the resh is flanked on either side by a kuf and a shin. That spells out the word Kodesh. One finds the Kedusha of Klal Yisrael when one appreciates Gvulim, when one appreciates borders. If what belongs to somebody else is outside of my Gvul, then I won't become envious and I'll discover extraordinary Kedusha, which is really just a restatement of the Yesod of the Ibn Ezra, right? That idea that it has nothing to do with me. This is someone else's, it's not mine, and therefore it's nothing to be envious about, it's just not shaykh to me. And with that understanding of the requirement to control the emotion of wanting what others have, maybe we could answer all the three questions we started with. You know, the Aseres HaDibros are 10 fundamental ideas, they're not 10 mitzvos. Rav Sadia Gaon, quoted by Rashi in Shmos Perek of Dalet and by the Ibn Ezra, teaches that all of Taryag mitzvos are included in these 10 headings. All 613 mitzvahs can be included in one of these 10 categories. So what are they? What are Dibros? Utterances, but what are they? They're categories for all the rest of the mitzvahs. There's something that encapsulates Kol HaTorah Kula. The Isra of Lo Sachmod is not out of place, because if a person has a proper recognition of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, which is the first category, the first set of three, and he has an understanding of his own createdness, which is the second set of three, those beliefs will give a person a sense of mission in life. Meaning, if I know that I've been created by Hashem and I have a proper appreciation of who Hashem is, of what Hashem is, to the extent that we're able to even understand any of that, we'll realize that we're put here with the tafkid, and whatever other people have been given has nothing to do with me. And when a person internalizes that message, then all of society's rules and conventions become so much easier to implement. You wouldn't commit those sins that arise from a false sense of entitlement and desire, which is the third category of the Aseres HaDibros. So it fits seamlessly into the Aseres HaDibros. Rav Daniel Stein, our very own Rav Daniel Stein, quotes from a Sefer Mishulchan Rabbi Eliyahu Baruch and Parshas Mishpatim. He quotes from Rav Shach that, of course, the Umos HaOlam, they were required to refrain from murder, adultery, and stealing because they're chayiv in Shav Mitzvahs. But they never had a requirement to make those values part of their essence. They were permitted to have the essential midos that would lead to those sins, as long as they don't actually do those sins, because society can't function if people are doing those sins. Notice the Medrash. The Medrash that everyone loves to quote, Kadosh Baruch Hu offered them the Torah, they didn't say, we can't do it. They said, kol atzman shel umazu, kol atzman shel aviyam. It's our very essence. It's who we are. Not to do it, that I can handle. Not to be it, that I can't do. It's kol atzman. The Kabbalah Satorah would have demanded that they change not just their behaviors, that they would have changed their essence. And that's something that they weren't willing to commit to do. So we who receive the Torah have to recognize that it's not enough to just observe the mitzvahs. You know, we talk in our yeshiva a lot about values, and we talk about it to the point where we make fun of it. But we have to realize that there's something there. because Judaism is not only a religion, it is also a religion of actions and things that you must do and can't do and things like, but it's also a religion, it's fundamentally, it's primarily a religion of values, of who we are. And we have to adjust our values and our self-definition to the point that those averos don't fit with the type of people that we are. You know, just in general, it's a hard thing for people, especially in a society where there is so much affluence. You know, it used to be that there was like one gvir in every community, and everyone knew he's the gvir, and everybody else is not the gvir. So like, you know, there was Rothschild, and you're not Rothschild, okay, so you move on with life. You know, it's like it wasn't, you know, there was like the billionaire. Now everyone knows a frum billionaire, right? Meaning who doesn't, right? Everyone knows, that person only has hundreds of millions. Like, we know people with like crazy amounts of money. So when you're not the person who has crazy amounts of money, like you find that envy sneaks in a little bit. You know, I always every year, the Shabbos of winter vacation. Like when I'm around on the Shabbos of winter vacation, it's like you look around the shul and it's like, you know, you almost feel like everyone's looking at each other. Whoever's there, the 12 people that are there, are like looking at each other like, well, I guess we're the people who didn't make it. You know, like on the last day before Pesach vacation, one of the rabbis in DRS, who probably doesn't want to be quoted, but if you know him, you know him. You know exactly who it is. There were fewer guys in class on the last day before Pesach vacation because everyone was already in Florida or wherever, in Cancun or wherever, I don't know, Utah, I don't know, wherever they go for Pesach vacation. And he goes, oh, I guess it's just me and the poor kids today. people think of those who are enjoying themselves in these exotic places, and it's a fool's errand. You know, if you were in Florida at an inexpensive hotel, you'd be looking at those in the Ritz. If you were in the Ritz, you'd be looking at those who have the penthouse suite. You know, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks said that when we say, he who has the most toys when he dies wins, you know, the operative word is toys, because it's the ethic of a kindergartner, you know, to think in such terms. So our job is always to be grateful for what we have, never to let other people's happiness diminish our own, and to the contrary, when we're not only happy and grateful for what we have, but we're happy and grateful for what others have, then we have so much more to be happy about. If we can actually train ourselves to be happy about other people's happiness, you'll find so much more to actually be happy about in life, and it's an important muster from the Aseret HaDibros. Okay.